We're talking with Dr. Alexander Wendt, who's had the courage to go ahead and talk about the great taboo, that is the UFO subject, asking why academics and scientists are unwilling to take this on, given the inherent curiosity in all of us as humans and the basic rule of science, you know, to investigate the unexplained, to tell the truth, which certainly is not happening. Government doesn't allow it. Science and academia unwilling to take it on. A lot of the media not willing to pursue these investigations as well. But Dr. Wendt has an idea about what a UFO study could look like. We're going to get into that in just a moment, and we'll open up the phone lines for your calls and questions and comments as well. Be right back. Alex, you had mentioned that in preparation for an interview on ancient aliens that you did this, got some media coaching, and that's how what led to the TEDx talk thing. Did you actually appear on Ancient Aliens?
Yes. I had 3 one-minute segments, I think, in one of the episodes. It was like the last episode this past season. And I haven't actually seen it, but I was told that I did fine. And but they're just short clips of it was an hour-long interview, and they pulled out the best pieces, I guess, for the show.
Yeah, that's sort of the way it goes. That would be scary for a guy in your position, because it's one thing to get a give a TED talk where you know what all the content's going to be, but you don't know what else is sandwiched around you in a TV show. And that Ancient Aliens has evolved. It's come a long way, does some great work, but you don't know what else is going to be in there.
Yeah, that's one reason I didn't watch the show.
So we talked about sort of some of the blowback. They flag your presentation. It's kind of a slap in the face, but you're okay with it because, you know, it kind of proves your point. Is there anything positive to come out of that? Do you get some media coverage? Do you get some new leads? Do people come forward? I was thinking about some of these Navy pilots. Do any of those people reach out and talk to you about it?
Yes, actually, I have had a couple conversations with pilots or people who are connected to the pilots, Kevin Day, for example. But in terms of other media attention, no, there's been none. As far as I know, and even locally at Ohio State, it wasn't covered in the student paper or anything like that. You'd think it might be because it's kind of a fun topic, but it hasn't reached the surface there. But on the other hand, it gets lots of views. So that's all I care about really in the end. And in the end, hopefully there'll be some more coverage of what we argued.
You know, the pilots, David Fravor and his colleagues there, and some of the other crew members of the Nimitz Carrier Group, were incredible people. They get, not only do they tell their story, and then the videos come out to sort of back it up, but there's some documents that have come forward. I helped release some of those, the analysis that was done internal by the Navy and other government entities. And then even more remarkable, at least to me, is that Congress takes an interest in it, that Congress starts hearing from these military personnel, that there are several closed-door briefings, and members of the Senate, and some of these very sensitive committees, military and intelligence committees, admit it. Yeah, we talked about it. Yeah, we're looking into it. That is, to me, astonishing, because just as no pilot wants to be the UFO pilot, and no scientist or, you know, academic wants to be the UFO professor, and no journalist wants to be the UFO reporter, certainly no senator wants to be the UFO senator, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think, I think what you just said is an important qualification to my claim earlier that, you know, there's a complete taboo on this. In fact, what we're seeing inside the government now are individuals who are starting to raise questions and push on this. So, and there probably is some internal study going on that we on the outside can't see. But again, it's not public, and I doubt it's going to become public anytime soon.
Well, I would have to agree with you on both of those. And but, you know, I got a feeling that there'll be information that slips out now and then. And I'm encouraged that there is, in fact, an ongoing study. You have an idea for a UFO study, and you pitched it in your TEDx talk. Tell me what you have in mind.
Well, I guess the context of the idea is that I've for a long time thought there were two tracks to pursue in challenging this taboo. There's the political track, which is what I did in the talk and what Tom DeLonge and others, Leslie Kane, have done in the New York Times editorials and so on, which is basically trying to put this issue out there and get the government to do something. And that's very important, and I'm all for that. That's not what we're doing in our group. We decided to pursue a scientific track, which I think is kind of goes alongside the political track. And the idea that we had, and we formed this nonprofit called UFO Data about 5 years ago, was to build a network of automated surveillance stations with all sky cameras and other simple technologies on the stations. And they would just monitor the sky 24/7. Anything comes along, triggers the station, and it starts recording as much physical data as possible. And the idea would be to build up a stock of actually scientifically usable data, as opposed to the anecdotes that is all we have really right now. And it's apparently quite cheap. We've done a lot of research on this. But the group, and we formed a group, it's a 501c3 nonprofit. We have about, I don't know, a dozen scientists in the shadows who don't want to be officially named, but they're kind of advisors and so on. But our business model was flawed, and so we never found a software engineer to actually write all the software you would need for one of these stations. And so our group has been somewhat moribund lately. But then a rival group, I wouldn't say rival, we discovered just a few months ago another group, a smaller one, UFO DAP, or UFO Data Acquisition Project. This is Chris O'Brien and Ron Olch. And they actually, Olch is a software engineer, and he was exactly the kind of person we were looking for, and he wrote the software, and they built a prototype, and they're now testing their machine. Same concept that we had. So at UFO Data, we've decided to, rather than just fold up shop and go home, we've decided to collaborate with UFO DAP, and so we're looking for ways to kind of divide up the labor and how can we support their efforts and so on. So there's really two groups now that are starting to talk to each other, each with different resources. And the hope is eventually, I think that building such a network would be hugely fascinating. It would not be that expensive. I think you would get tremendous public interest in this. And this would all be, in a sense, away from the state, away from the government. It would be a bottom-up effort rather than a top-down kind of effort. I think the top-down effort will take a long time because the government doesn't want it.
So people can make a tax-deductible donation to this 501c3. Do you have a range of dollar figures about how much you need to raise to get it going?
Well, each UFO DAPS system, their stations are in the $5,000 and under range. They're designed to be relatively cheap. The technology is very, very powerful now compared to even 10 or 20 years ago, and the prices have come way down. So, you know, we're hoping to buy one of the stations ourselves at UFO Data very soon. So I think for, you know, a few $100,000 raised online through crowdfunding when the time came, and you could build a very interesting network of maybe a dozen or two dozen machines. And from there, potentially this could be a global network. So there's no limit in a sense to how large it could be. Excuse me.
Yeah, I guess if you get a dozen or so going and one of them gets lucky, you get an image that is newsworthy and gets spread around the world. That would be one way that get a lot of attention and maybe some donations in a hurry.
Yes.
That, you know, you make the point in your presentations that sort of our concept of truth of what is capable of as possible changes. And, you know, 150 years ago, the idea of human flight, us building a machine that could fly, our physics told us it wasn't possible. We couldn't do it. And you look at the idea of if they are ET, they, I'm using air quotes around it, if they are from somewhere else, that they're an older civilization, we can't even imagine what their technology could be. Even 1,000 years older than us, look at how far we've come in 1,000 years technology-wise. So the argument that's often made by the debunkers or scientists who don't want to take this on is that, well, we can't get there. We're not able to get to other star systems, so therefore they can't get here, is pretty weak.
Yeah, I think it's extraordinarily weak, and there's a level of human hubris there that as if what we know is somehow close to the limit of what could be known. And my own feeling is that human beings know much less than we think we do. There are gigantic gaps in our knowledge of the universe, even our knowledge of ourselves. So I think this argument that the scientists somehow can say that we know they can't get here, I think We have no way of saying that. I'm not saying they can get here. I'm just saying that we haven't done the science either way to know. And so the only position that's really rational to take is a completely agnostic position. You have to be completely agnostic in order to make any progress on this issue. One thing I would just add to that, though, there is a troubling or scary kind of question that I've been thinking about lately in terms of, you know, ETs visiting. What if they're not visiting? What if they actually live here? What if they've lived here for a very, very long time and that they have an interplanetary civilization and this just happens to be one of their, you know, places to hang out? And that's a very unsettling thought because then clearly human beings are not masters of our own house. Now, of course, I don't know if that's true. Maybe they are just visiting if they're here at all. But the idea of them living here, perhaps on the ocean floor or in the sky or whatever, is something that, you know, I just kind of start thinking about lately, I guess.
Well, I think that there's an argument to be made there that they have been here a long time, that they live here. Maybe they've been here throughout human history and have been watching us develop, and they live among us without us being really able to see them all the time. We only get glimpses when they allow it. That is spooky, for sure. I think that, you know, you have centuries of human experience and testimonials, anecdotal for sure, but it's been throughout the world for as long as there's been recorded history of events we would categorize as like a UFO right now. And yet all those millions of people who think they've seen one, science tells them, no, you haven't. It can't be, therefore it isn't. I think it hurts the credibility of science at a time when we need to believe in science, you know, the virus that's going on now, and it hurts the credibility of government to deny this, to call its own pilots liars, to clearly withhold information. Talk about it from the perspective of a political scientist, what that does to the credibility of government overall. You file a FOIA request and you get shut down. You know that this information exists, but you get nothing but blanked out or scratched out pieces of paper or nothing at all. The big picture, what that does to the credibility of government and the military.
Well, I think this is what we've been living with now for 70-some years. In that sense, the fact that the government doesn't release these things is not news to anybody. The attitude of the government and the scientific community is well known. So it's not as if the credibility is going down. It's just it's sort of been a constant for a long time. And I do think, too, that even in the question is really credibility among who, because the government and the scientific community, their main concern is credibility among themselves, in a sense. And then there's the rest of us in the general public. And some people in the public, quote unquote, are believers, and some people are not believers. And so the credibility issue, I think, is hard to sort of assess one way or the other. And by not investigating and by keeping the issue taboo, in some ways, the government maintains its credibility as the sole actor that can protect us from threats and everything else. So the credibility argument can cut either way, I think. But it is beginning to crack. I think that you're seeing more and more people, starting with the pilots and others, who are beginning to say, hey, wait a minute, and let's begin to talk about this more openly.
In the introduction to this interview, I mentioned about your personal webpage, how you're free there to explore more personal viewpoints where you don't have to worry about embarrassing your employer. And you write in one section of it that if the past is not a reliable guide to the future, then the intellectual challenge as a social scientist is to free oneself from the, quote, tyranny of the real in the present. By that, I don't mean stop believing in reality, but to see it as only the starting point for the imagination, not the end. And then you get into the idea of consciousness, where you express an interest in that concept. It's clearly you've been thinking about these things for a while.
Yeah, the consciousness issue is similar, and it's similar in the sense that it's very puzzling. This is something that human beings also do not understand. We have no clue where consciousness comes from, and yet clearly it's very important to us. And I think it's more evidence of my general view that human beings know a lot less about the universe than we think we do. But yes, I have been interested in the consciousness issue for quite a while. It doesn't necessarily connect with the UFO one, except that it does illustrate, I think, some of the same conservative tendencies, intellectually conservative tendencies, that we see in the scientific community more generally.
We'll come back to your personal webpage in a moment. There's some folks on the phones that want to talk to you. Just keeping in mind, folks, as you're calling in, Dr. Wendt is an academic. He hasn't drank all the Kool-Aid, so we don't want to embarrass him with this. Okay, all right. You've sipped on it a little bit. All right. But we'll take a couple of calls and see how they go. East of the Rockies, Josh in Indiana. How you doing?
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Sure. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Hi, Dr. Wendt. My question, kind of bear with me as I try to express this and the intent of what I'm getting at here. But if we look at the process of disclosure as a slow trickle of concessions of truth, with the first being, this first major one being, we can all accept that a phenomena, with the keyword there being a phenomena, exists. What would then be perhaps the next concession we could get people to agree upon in the process? Does history provide us with any precedents with regard to paradigm shifts of this nature as to how we might move to that second step of concession or acceptable truth in this whole process?
That's a really good question, actually, whether the history of science more generally provides any insight. I haven't actually thought about that before. I mean, science is a very conservative enterprise, and so scientists will hang on to theories in the face of contrary evidence for quite some time. I think that's what's happening in the UFO case. And usually when you get paradigm shifts like that, it's because of generational change. It's not like all of a sudden the scientific community realizes, oh, wait a minute, we just made a huge mistake. It's more like the younger folks come along and they're the ones who are challenging the orthodoxy. So at least that's the sort of standard view of where scientific change comes from. Whether that will happen here, I don't know. I think it depends partly on the government's attitude because they can control the release of information. The fact that the Navy came out at all was a huge change, and so totally unexpected. So maybe the situation is more encouraging than I think, but I don't see the government, especially the leaders of the government, anytime soon endorsing this as an issue that should be explored. It's probably going to have to come from the bottom up rather than the top down.
Thanks, Josh. It's interesting for you as a political scientist, Alex, to look at issues about the president, whether presidents get briefed on this. You know, there's a lot of speculation in UFO world about that, and some pretty good evidence that at least a few of them have been very curious about it and have tried to find out and have been thwarted, Bill Clinton being one. I know for sure that he tried. There have been statements about UFOs from several presidents. There's even been a book or two written about what the presidents might know about it. And the idea that maybe they're not told everything so that they can have plausible deniability is not exactly without some foundation. We're going to have to take a break here now. We're talking with Dr. Alexander Wendt, and a lot of folks are on the phones. We'll get back and take as many of your calls as we can. We are getting the lowdown from Dr. Alexander Wendt, Ohio State University political scientist, who, as I described earlier, delivered an excellent TEDx talks earlier this year, actually end of last year. It was put online this year back in February, and then it was immediately flagged by the TEDx folks as being outside their boundaries of what's acceptable. It's sort of like a slap in the face. Dr. Wendt is not entirely unhappy with that, since it sort of confirms what one of his thesis was. On our Coast to Coast webpage, we have in the introduction to this part of the program, we have a link to Alex's personal page where he writes on a wider variety of subjects, and you can check that out. We also have a link to the TEDx video. It's about 12 or 13 minutes long, and you can check that out yourself and see how solid of a presentation it is based on fact and how reasonable the arguments are. And it makes the response from some of these TEDx folks all the more ridiculous. And I also have Sovereignty and the UFO. That's the paper that he co-wrote with Raymond Duvall of the University of Minnesota that started it off. It was first published in 2008. But if you haven't seen it, you should check that out. It's a great read. And we'll get to the phone lines with as many of your calls as we can in the next segment of Coast to Coast AM. Alex, a quick question before we go back to the phones. It's about sovereignty and the UFO, the paper you co-wrote with Raymond Duvall, University of Minnesota. Are you still in touch with him, and has he had any feedback about the paper himself? Hello? I think we might have lost our guest. We'll just hang on here for a second, and Donna will try to reestablish contact. I did want to mention, you know, we were talking about in the news segment of the program, sort of having time to, with the virus and the shutdown and the quarantines, we have time to sort of reflect on the state of the earth. You'll recall that a month ago, we had a guest, Wayne Pacelli, here on Coast to Coast to talk about wet markets and the source of the virus. Oh, okay. All right. Well, apparently we do have Alex back now. Alex, I was going to ask about Raymond Duvall, University of Minnesota, and this paper that you guys co-wrote, Sovereignty and the UFO, which Greg Bishop, I think, is going to tweet it out here soon or put it on the Coast to Coast website. Are you still in touch with him, and did he get feedback about that paper?
Well, he was my graduate advisor for my PhD, so I've known him for my entire career. We're good friends now, and he just retired. He's let me take all the feedback. As he'd like to joke, we use the phrase, we describe ourselves as militant agnostics, and he said, well, I'm the militant and he's the agnostic. So he's kept some distance, but he was supportive and he provided some crucial ideas in the paper. I should also point out that that paper, there's a much more reader-friendly and a shorter version of that paper in Leslie Kane's excellent volume in 2010 called UFOs, which she solicited the paper from us when she heard about it, and we wrote a new version of it. So people should check that out if they want to.
Yeah, that's great. Leslie is a courageous journalist, excellent reporter.
Absolutely.
He's been my guest and a friend of mine for a long time. We'll go back to the phone lines. First-time caller, Steve in Montreal. Hi, Steve. You're on with Alex Wendt.
Actually, I'm calling from Ottawa. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
All right. Montreal. Okay. I basically agree with the reasoning presented by the doctor regarding thoughts of the powers that be to not really addressing this issue directly. But I'd like to ask a couple of questions related to this and related to the potential intentions of the extraterrestrials, if they do exist. And in my opinion, their intentions probably would fall under three possible categories. They're either here to help us, or to observe and learn, or to dominate and exploit. Those are general categories, mind you, that I have notions that they might be motivated by. And I'm just wondering what the doctor's opinion is on the fact that is it likely that their intentions are good towards us the longer that no overt attempts are made to dominate or exploit the Earth and, of course, humanity? And the second question I have is a related question, and that is regarding that famous gold record that was sent out with the 1977 Voyager out in the universe, if I'm not mistaken. I'm looking at it on the internet here. It reveals a tremendous amount of information about us. And I think I recall Stephen Hawking, shortly before he died, stating a warning to humanity that, you know, it's quite possibly advisable for us to keep a low profile when we think about activities of broadcasting our existence to the universe.
All right, Steve, let's let Alex jump into that. You know, my reaction, if I were the ETs, I'd be saying about that gold record, send more Chuck Berry. But Alex, what do you think about first the idea that Hawking's warnings?
Well, I mean, I think it is understandable, and there is an interesting question whether maybe ignorance is bliss and we should not be looking into this issue at all. And we want to avoid contact if there is any, you know, are any ETs in the neighborhood and so on. And that, you know, why not let a sleeping dog lie? So I think that the question he was raising about the Voyager thing is an important one that needs to be discussed. But it should be discussed, and we should have a strategy then. Do we want to do this or not? But it does come back to the first question the caller asked, which I thought was a good one about hostile intentions, there is a fourth possibility, which is that they're not interested in us at all. They may be here for other reasons completely, and we just happen to be the local inhabitants, and they just have to get out of our way. Personally, I don't think that's the most likely, and of course, who knows? This is all speculation, but I do think that the longer it goes with no sign of overt hostility, the less likely it is that any ETs that are here have hostile intentions. So my guess is that, and this argument has been made by others, that any civilization that survived long enough to be capable of interstellar travel would almost certainly have to have become peaceful and would not have hostile intentions. Basically, if they wanted to conquer and exterminate us, they would have done that a long time ago, it seems to me. So I don't see any evidence of hostile intention at all. But that doesn't mean their intentions are benign either. So,
thanks for the call, Steve. I guess, you know, you boil it down to why are they here if they are here. That's the really big source of the taboo, is that that's really what scares us. We don't know.
Yeah, that's right. And almost any answer, even if they're here to help, could be destructive because our society might collapse in the face of such a profoundly unexpected and profoundly superior force as these creatures must be if they're here. So in a way, even the good intentions don't save us necessarily. There's going to be a real challenge in managing our own response if and when a contact scenario actually occurs.
Also, what does not save us, choosing to not study them, they don't go away because we don't study them. They're here. They've been here, if you believe the reports we've had from over the centuries. And just the fact that we put a blanket over our head and don't look at them, it doesn't make them go away either. I don't think
that's true. On the other hand, as long as they're not bothering us, then the sleeping dogs argument kind of argument kicks in. And but yes, no, I take your point. Yeah.
West of the Rockies, Mike in Reno. Hi, Mike. You're on with Alex Wendt.
Hi. In addition to what's being said, the main scientific taboo is that it overthrows the sovereignty of Darwinian evolution, which has dominated Western science since 1859 and his book, The Origin of Species. That's been accepted science materialism. I'm reading a little on Freud now. And all of Freud's theories were based on Darwin, on the body, and on reductionist science. The problem with Darwin, by the way, for the left, and I have another objection, is it's called a theory because it can't be replicated in the laboratory. You can't replicate a billion or half a billion years in the laboratory, which is the basis of it not being, you know, it jumping from theory to acceptance. As long as it can't be proved by experiment, it's theoretical. The other thing now, which is much more controversial and subtle, is that it's racist. And the left opposition to this, and Jimmy Church has come under attack, is that we can't have superior races. This in itself doesn't contradict Darwin, because you know, Darwin's cousin Francis Dalton coined the term eugenics, which led to a lot of racism. But this is the left's latest attack. We can't have superior races, and so they're going to attack all of you people for being racist. So you got in addition, the religions look upon them as demons. So there's a whole stew of opposition to this, but it's cracking. And you know, whether, as you said, whether we want to admit it or not, we're going to have to share our, you know, our place in the universe. And it's shocking, but I don't think there's any alternative. If you have any comments on that, thanks, George.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, there's a lot there. I certainly agree that there is a challenge here to Darwinian thinking, and there are many sort of parts of humanity's knowledge of the world, or what we think is our knowledge of the world, that are potentially threatened by this phenomenon, because all of our knowledge assumes that we're alone and that we're in charge. I do think that though there is one continuity there, if you think about the Darwinian Revolution, part of the consequence of that was to make human beings less central, less the center of the universe. And likewise, the Copernican Revolution also made human beings less central. So there is kind of a historical trend over the past few centuries to demote human beings in a way and make us part of just nature as a whole. And this UFO phenomenon in a way continues that process. And if we do finally come to grips with it, and if we do discover that there are ETs, then it'll become very clear that we're not at the top of the food chain, but somewhere in the middle at best, probably.
Yeah, the march of science is a lesson in humility. More we know about the universe, the less significant we become.
Right.
I know there's a lot of folks on the phones, but I wanted to address this famous quote from Carl Sagan that always pops up. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And I've always wondered, well, why don't claims just require regular evidence? And I think of it in the context of UFOs. We generally, people who study this say 90% of them can probably be explained. They're misidentifications of planets or planes or birds or something like that. Forgetting that, you know, when it comes to UFOs, it only takes one. You don't need 1,000 of them. If one is proven to be real, it's profound.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I think that, and what is the claim here? The claim is not that, the initial claim is not, oh, UFOs are here and they're ETs. The initial claim is there are some weird things in the sky. We have no idea what they are. Let's go study them. That right. argument does not require extraordinary evidence. If you look at those Navy videos, that's enough evidence for me to think, hey, some scientists should go check this out. So I think in a way, Sagan's argument is overstated, or he's assuming that he's several leaps down the road in a sense. And we need to stick with what we really know, the real facts that we can get a grip on, and that is simply the kind of things that the Navy videos show. That's all we have for facts. Let's start there and just start investigating.
Yeah, and if you really do need extraordinary evidence, the way to go get it is to study it, to get going.
Through science.
Yeah. We go to the wild card line, Cornelius in Louisiana. Hi, Cornelius. Good morning.
Hey, George and Dr. Wendt. God bless both of y'all. George, this is my second time talking to you. I was a military police officer, had top secret clearance and stuff. And my question, I was telling Miss Donna Walker, in the American Legion magazine this month, Mays magazine, it's got an article about the military and UFOs and stuff. So I hope you'll check that out, Dr. Wendt. And George, I'm going to tell you something real quick. I believe that this COVID-19 is a biological bomb. Like I said, I studied this when I was a military police officer, but it was with the Russians. So that's my point on that. But if you check out that magazine, I think that would be a good thing for you, the military and UFOs. American Legion magazine.
I think that article was written by Chris Mellon, who's now working with TTSA, but he's a longtime intelligence officer, worked for the Senate Intelligence Committee, and then was an intelligence undersecretary, secretary of some level in the Pentagon for years. But thanks. Yeah, that's a good article. Alex, you should check that out for sure. Thank you, Cornelius, absolutely, for calling and mentioning it to us. We're going to Mike in Maui. Hey, Mike.
Hi there.
What's on your mind?
Hello, this is Mike.
Hi, Mike. What's on your mind?
How you doing there?
We're doing well.
I've kind of found a way to use my cell phone and take pictures of scenery and stuff and then refract the light. And I'm going to tell you that I've found some interesting creatures, I'd have to say, that aren't from here, that are inside. They're all around us, basically. They live right on this planet. So, and I'm not crazy. I'm not on drugs or anything like that. But I'd just like to say that I've done this for about a year now, and I've checked on different cell phones and done this. And I just want to challenge the listeners to take their cell phone, take a few snapshots out there, refract the light, the dark shadows in the trees, and see if they can find what I found.
Well, Mike, why don't you send us some of those photos? I'll take a look at them. I appreciate it if you send them to either me or...
I got more. I've taken pictures of the moon landing and the Mars rover shots, and I've also found civilizations on Mars and crafts.
I'll tell you what, Mike, you send them to us, we'll take a look at them, but we're getting a little off the track for my guest Alex, but I'm happy to take a look at them if you want to email some of them to me or to Coast to Coast AM, the website. Thanks for calling. Alex, do you have thoughts about maybe pursuing this further in maybe a book form or additional articles, or do you think you got to lay low for a while?
Well, at this stage, I'm all in with the TEDx talk. So, but I have thought. I mean, this has for me always been a bit of a side light in my writing and my career, and so I can't devote too much time to it. But I have thought about what a follow-on article might look like to the one I did before, and I haven't sort of figured that out yet. But I am beginning to think about a follow-on article, eventually a book. That probably would be after I retire, but there's clearly a book's worth of material here. I am interested in the whole pre-contact scenario. In a way, I guess the question that's animating me lately is, if we are now in a pre-contact situation, how do we do that? How do we prepare for that? You know, what's the best way to think about that, to prepare the population and so on, just in case something is discovered? So that's one angle, but others have written on these contact things too, and I would need to get up to speed on the writing that's already been done before I had a clearer idea.
There's a book by Richard Dolan and Bryce Zabel called AD After Disclosure that imagines some scenarios that'd be worth checking out. Dr. Alexander Wendt, thanks so much for being here. Hope you're not in any trouble, and if you are, you come back and let us know, and we'll raise some hell about it.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Really appreciate it, what you've been doing, and can't wait to see whatever you write next. Thanks very much. Talk to you again. Our next guest, we're coming up with Patrick Harper, Daemonic Reality. It's a heck of a read. I think you're going to enjoy it.